everybody, and welcome back to Sequelizers, the show all about fixing the bad sequels that followed good movies. As always, I am your host, Jack Chambers, and joining me are my three sequelizing colleagues, Mr. Matthew Stogden.
Brah.
Mr. Tim Matum.
Hello.
And Mr. Alec Plowman.
Something to do with stick shift, I don't know.
Cars. Don't know. Yeah. Urgh. Men, cars, birds, etc.
Birds? Yes.
As in women.
It's not a British equivalent.
Oh, who would you cast in a British equivalent to this film?
I think Jason, we know the answer.
Jason Statham is the answer.
Ray Winston.
Yeah.
Michael Caine.
It's just that bad version of the Italian Job.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, with Ed Norton.
Oh,
glorious.
We're not fixing the Italian Job, ladies and gentlemen, because that film's garbage.
Yeah. The remake.
The Statham one. Yeah.
And Requalizers.
Ooh.
Just a matter of time.
That's a plan. That's a future plan. Fix the Italian Job remake. Good Lord. Good luck to you all. Godspeed, Jack, with the Italian Job remake.
We don't. See you next week.
Yeah. So speaking of speed, we're going to be fixing a sequel to some consider it a classic. It's kind of spun off into a very successful franchise, but kind of had a meager beginnings, I would say. Too Fast, Too Furious from the year 2003.
If only it had been 2002.
Right.
They missed a trip.
How did they not do Too Fast, Too Furious 2002?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, too many zeros.
Because June the previous year, the film had just come out, the first one, so there's no time.
But like forward planning, you know what I mean?
No one's forward. It's 2000s. Everyone's worried about Y2K.
And I don't think they were particularly predicting that the first one would be sequel worthy.
That's true. Yeah, I think the real problem was they were worried that, yeah, the first one might not be successful. The Fast and the Furious.
I think it was just a case of just making it and see what would happen. And the answer was, oh, it was all right.
And then suddenly, one of the biggest movie franchises in the world.
Fuck, 15 years later, whatever the fuck it is.
We made a film that spoke to a generation after reading an article in a magazine about street racing and going, that sounds like it might be fun.
Yeah.
Let's option that.
Not about street racing, Alec. It's about family.
Family. I mean, but it is about street racing, just to clarify. Street
races are... The films barely feature street racing.
No, they're heists now.
It's all like big fucking superhero action movies, basically.
Okay, so I will admit at this point that I have only seen The Fast and the Furious and Too Fast, Too Furious.
Which for this episode is fine.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
If anything, you'll have a more neutral perspective than we will.
I think at which point I liked The Fast and the Furious when I first saw it, and then I saw Too Fast, Too Furious. And I'm like, no, I'm done. apparently, they got good again at some
point. From like five onwards, yeah.
I mean, that is the miracle of this franchise, is that it really meandered. I would say either the second or the fourth are probably the weakest.
Two and four are definitely the weakest.
Three is very poorly thought of, but it is not as bad as people remember.
Three is a functional film. Mm. Like it works. It's not very Fast and Furious in terms of like relating back to the first one, but I think it's a redemption compared to the second one. Mm-hmm. The second one is definitely where the rot set in, which is kind of our rule for these franchises.
I find it so bizarre that this is a franchise that picked up at film number five.
Right?
Yeah.
How did they even get to five?
That's the thing I've ever... Well, they all made all the money, didn't they?
Well, effectively, the thing with five is it was kind of a bit of a reboot. And so they just changed direction, pivoted what they were doing with it, and it became a very different genre film. Kind of like the Alien sort of thing in a weird way. So they had a chance to retain some characters, retain the bits that worked, shave it down, make it something different, introduce The Rock covered in baby oil with roids, and said, look, it's now a chase. And you're like, and it's like, okay. And it's so flamboyantly ridiculous. And this is kind of the thing we'll get to in a minute. People remember Too Fast, Too Furious very negatively without, in all honesty, analyzing why they think it's bad. Whereas, in truth, it doesn't do anything really any differently to the later films. We just remember it not being as good, even though it's kind of the exact same fucking film. They're all basically the same film. Yeah, it's like it jumped a car into a boat for 20 feet. That's ridiculous. It's like, and you're okay with a fucking car jumping from a building to another building, and you're fine with that for $1 billion.
See, I would say the ridiculous parts are fine. Like the jumping a car onto a boat, in terms of the progression of the insanity of this series, it works fine enough. Mm. Like the big stunt from the first film is the kind of the heist at the end where everything's going wrong and you know, Paul Walker's trying to catch up with them and stuff like that. And then it gets to, yeah, let's jump a car onto a boat. And then it slowly progresses. We get the terrible CGI car chase in Fast and Furious, the fourth one. And then by number five, we've got let's drag a stolen safe through Rio, demolishing buildings as we go. And it's at the level that has become this huge juggernaut franchise suddenly. For me, the parts where this film like really sags is when it's not doing insane stuff and when it's kind of trying to still be this sort of slightly grounded crime drama, like because it just is not, the characters aren't good enough to support that. The acting isn't good enough to support that.
The acting is not good.
The script is not good enough to support that. Yeah. Like it's only really fun when it starts getting really outlandish.
It does feel like a made-for-TV cop drama, sort of disposable Miami Vice episode that happens to have a budget behind it with street racing elements and drug cartel things and stuff.
It's weird because that sounds very little like the first The Fast and the Furious movie, which I think is one of the strange things with Too Fast, Too Furious, is that right from the get-go, this does not feel like a sequel to The Fast and the Furious.
Correct.
There's a quote from Vin Diesel, who looked at, and I'm not sure which script he is talking about, whether it's because, so a bit of context here, they, around the time that they wanted to make a sequel, once the first one was a hit, they pitched it to Vin Diesel. They weren't sure if he was going to come back, and they had two scripts, one with Vin in it and one without Vin in it. And this is a quote from Vin Diesel from, I think it's a Variety interview in 2015, where he says about the second film, they didn't take a Francis Ford Coppola approach to it, which is a very weird thing to say about a Fast and Furious film. They approached it like they did sequels in the 80s and 90s when they would drum up a new story, unrelated for the most part, and slap the same name on it. Now, I don't know which draft he was talking about there, whether it's the one that had him in it or the one without him.
It's the one with him in it, from what I understand, because they actually started shooting this film with the script, hoping that he would finally say yes. And then they go, oh, fuck, we don't have Vin Diesel.
And he got,
let's just scramble the rest of this film together. And
yeah, he got tempted by Chronicles of Riddick. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. He had had the success of Pitch Black and then gone off to make
that bit of a sequel, I think.
It does feel, but that comment, I think, rings true to the movie that you get as Too Fast, Too Furious. Because it doesn't really feel like the sequel to The Fast and the Furious. Other than Paul Walker being there, it's more or less ignores everything that happens in the
film.
No, it's
Alec didn't say Paul Walker's acting. He just said his presence.
Yeah, Paul Walker is like...
He's there, I guess.
He's in it. But I mean, you know, and he's the same character. But other than a throwaway thing at the beginning where they're like, hey, you know, we're going to arrest you if you carry on street racing because you left. that's just it. That's
Have you seen the prelude? Which is the fucking, basically a shitty music video.
God, it's the worst.
Yeah. It's absolutely worst. Paul Walker hangs his badge up and then just drives across country and hooks up with, well, not hook up with a lady. She just gives him a lift somewhere. And he makes his way, you know, do a bit of street racing, bit of cash, and finally ends up in Miami. And it's like, oh, okay, that's the opening of your film.
That's how he gets from one place to another.
I'm aware of the existence of the prelude. I haven't seen it. But that sounds, sounds like
something
less
than the film, and that's saying something.
Right. That does sound like something that's integral to
what
should be happening in the movie, though. But anyway, so yeah, I think that's a problem with it. It doesn't really feel like it just kind of abandons so much of the stuff from the first one.
Well, what we need to do here is really discuss, with hindsight, the escalation of the series, because effectively you start with the knowledge of, oh, well, what makes the Fast and Furious films successful? What is, in inverted commas, a Fast and Furious film? And we will always think of, arguably, 5, 6, 7, and with a weird degree, 8. And, you know, the big bombastic set pieces through tearing through towns and lots of really not a lot of street racing. Everyone, it's just cars and tanks and big shit and planes and endless runways and all that nonsense.
The one that has the most street racing is 3.
Yeah, exactly.
Very focused on street racing for whatever reason.
When I think of The Fast and the Furious. And again, my knowledge of this franchise comes largely from film number one.
Yeah.
The thing that I think of is Point Break, but with nitrous oxide.
You're entirely correct.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, it's often
Point Break, not.
Yeah, yeah. It's often pointed out that it's exactly the same premise and the same plot. And it is, entirely. It's literally to the end and everything. What's interesting, however, is that if we were to suddenly say, okay, well, we know what makes these successful. We know what the public wants. We'll just give them to them early. If you do that in 2003, people will reject it immediately out of hand. You can't just jump in and say, right, okay, now we fixed it by doing this too soon. It's a weird...
You'd go too fast, too furiously.
Too hard, too soon.
Because it sounds to me like actually what you get in the subsequent films from 5 onwards actually has very little to do with the first film anyway. That's how they were able to make such a successful reboot, is essentially just making a different film and slapping the same name on it.
Pretty much.
The consistent elements are essentially these people are very good at driving, they live outside the law, and... Vin Diesel will mumble the word family a lot.
They do also become effectively highly trained killers, like Navy SEAL.
They
go from being literally trying to shoot at cops very badly and too fast, in very realistic action sequences, which we'll talk about in a minute, well, in terms of the fighting at least, to standing up on a ski-mobile and plugging people with a pistol, perfectly killing them in one shot. Like, that's like train killer level stuff.
Like multi-story car park fight with the chain and stuff, and it's all crumbling around. It's a fucking superhero fight.
Yes. Yeah, they are superhero
films. They're basically both Luke Cage with like indestructible skin, and they're just falling off buildings and then going like, oh, that's like, better dust myself off and carry on fighting
Vin Diesel
the other guy.
Launches himself across the flyover to catch Michelle Rodriguez and crash into a car, goes, it's like, thank you, Vin. Why saved the fucking day.
Why have I not seen any of these films? This sounds great.
You would love them, Alec. I'm going to lie.
This sounds
with
5. Hey? Ludicrous? Yeah, because 6, technically 3 is 7, isn't it? In the running order.
Yes.
Yeah, it goes 1, 2, correct. 4, 5, 6, 3, correct. 7, 8.
Yeah, something like that.
Hobbs right. Shaw, 9.
Sure.
Well, okay.
We talk about the kind of the ridiculous level there. There's a bit in, I think it's number 6, it might be 7.
Who knows? They all blur together.
Where Paul Walker is suddenly like doing Jackie Chan like level fighting. And it's like, wait, didn't he just used to be a cop? A detective.
He's a guy called Brian.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know.
Brian and Dominic as the two main parts. They sound like just... Those guys who sat at the back in sixth form,
They
were really into like
nitrous oxide.
Yeah, they were those guys who were really into cars. Yeah.
I think I'm gonna pimp out my microdom. I'm gonna get a giant exhaust and it's gonna go bro. I was reading Max Power the other day.
I mean,
and they was talking about NOS.
To be fair, we were sitting in the back of a class. We were talking about comics and pretending to like riff out guitar riffs. So we're not pretending to. You know what I mean? Not allowed a guitar in class.
I think as much as we mock Vin Diesel, he is weirdly crucial to this franchise, I think. And also the thing about family that kind of only really comes in the fifth film, and then it becomes so central to the film.
That is the central theme across the next.
Exactly.
Yeah. And this dearest family.
Exactly. Yeah. This,
although that is kind of present in the first one as well.
Well, I
think it brings back the one, like, 2 and 3 are just other fucking stuff, and then,
And I think that's the thing, is that it's about both literal family and this kind of extended family of people who, you know, they trust and stuff like that. And it is present in the first one, and then it goes away for definitely the second and third ones.
Like a decade.
For like a decade. And it kind of comes back in the fourth, even though the fourth is very bad. It reunites the original cast, and so they can start talking about that idea again. Mm. And I think that when we talk about number 2 not feeling like a Fast and Furious film, that is one of the elements that it misses out on. It doesn't have the same relationship set up that the first one did, and that the series would go on to, you know, have at the center.
Which I find, frankly, fucking bizarre. Just because if you ever see the behind the scenes or the bloopers stuff of Paul Walker and Tyrese Gibson interacting, they have actually genuine chemistry in real life. I mean, they're really silly frat boys punching each other.
They were friends in real life.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, it feels natural.
And then the cameras start rolling and all that fades away and they become
disappears.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, they had such great chemistry and they were so good together. And they're riffing off each other perfectly. It's like, and they were joking the same sort of humor. It's like, why isn't this in the film? Why don't I see this? Why isn't this part of this? And the same way that ultimately we think of like Vin Diesel and Paul Walker having a bit of a good dynamic together, for example. But we don't really see that with these characters. It's true off camera, but not on camera. So that family dynamic, that definitely exists. It just doesn't appear.
Yeah, I think a big problem with me for so much of the dialogue is that because they went in with that script that had planned for Vin Diesel, they just fucking improvised a bunch of stuff. Mm. And apparently John Singleton, the director, was just like, you're in a room, talk about cars and stuff. What? Really? You're going to write like funny dialogue for us or anything? Nah.
You'll figure it out.
Just talk about stuff, you know, be fine. And you could really tell, like you said, when they go from like actually being friends in real life to be like, now act, but also improv, which neither of you are good at. Okay.
You end up with an ejecto-cito.
Fuck off, ejecto-cito. Jesus Christ. What a fucking line that is. Good Lord. Oh, yeah, apparently like a huge majority of this film is just improvised because Singleton and the cast basically had no idea what they were doing and were just winging it on set.
John Singleton seems like a bit of a left field for this movie anyway. I mean, I know Boys in the Hood kind of, I can see why in some respects, but in other respect, he feels a bit of a strange choice for.
I think Boys in the Hood gets him a lot of credit. He's literally, because he's from South Central LA, that's all very. He's grown up with that sort of environment. He's aware of it and thinks, "Oh, this is amazing. Why don't we do this sort of thing?" And the fact that he is probably, as weird as this sounds, one of the highest, technically critically acclaimed, because he's been, you know, his film was nominated for Best Picture for Oscar or Best Writing at least. It was like, oh well, hang on a minute. That's an multi-Oscar nominated director who's been in charge of this film. It's a logical, it's the kind of thing we would suggest. It's like, okay, who would we do to get this thing? It's like, well,
the Boys in the Hood guy.
Boys
get
in the
him,
Hood.
Yeah.
Singleton was great. It made sense. The problem was that, because he went into it and said, oh, I want to really replicate something like Top Gun. I want the action to be cool. I want to be like this and that and the other. And really what you end up with is someone who doesn't really do this kind of action. In the early 2000s, where after like Will Smith's fucking Miami video at the end of the 90s, it sort of, as weird as it sounds, cements the visual thing that Michael Bay was pushing with this, put the deep saturation and the high contrast, put that all in there and make these ridiculous cuts. I mean, like the music video for Too Fast, Too Furious, or the songs that Ludacris did, it dictates how the film looks as well. It's this very oily looking things. I mean, it's weird to look back on like the early 2000s. Like, what does it look like? I'll tell you what it fucking looks like. That and The Matrix. It's on like some high saturation and slow-mo motherfucking shit. But this is the kind of the interesting point whereby Singleton makes sense for the drama, except the drama is boring and the action doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And some of it's CGI and looks terrible. And we go inside the car for some reason and sort of like,
and some of it is weirdly practical. Like, Tim, you mentioned the car diving on a boat thing. Mm-hmm. Like, they really shot that.
Yes.
Mm. It's a one take.
Yeah.
Done. That's the stunt. Yeah. It's boring. Yeah. That's the big stunt of the whole fucking film. And it's like, cool. Okay. You drove a car onto a boat. Sure.
And the fact that, like, John Singleton had done Boys in the Hood, grown up in South Central, like, had an idea of this culture, which, you know, For its various flaws, The Fast and the Furious does feel very located in a place, that first film. And then they go, oh, that's great. We're going to move you across the country to Miami.
But just for no discernible reason. There's no like, oh, yeah, we can do this really cool, unique thing in Miami.
Yeah.
Fuck it. It's the same thing. Basically, moved it
but we're
for
just,
no reason.
We're going to just assume that Miami has a completely, basically identical like street racing culture.
That's a really good point, actually, with no
difference.
Same thing, different town.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is the thing about Singleton, just the last point of Singleton. I find it interesting because if we think about Fast and the Furious, which I genuinely enjoy the Fast and Furious, the first one. I think it's one of my favorite ones of the franchise because it's just very simple.
I thought you were about to say it's one of my favorite films.
No, it's very straightforward. It's just it's a nice thing, but it was very much of its time period as well. Yeah. Full of fairy tales,
of course.
But it's directed by Rob fucking Cohen.
Yeah,
and Rob Cohen of Dragonheart and The Skulls, and it's like, and Rob Cohen, who went on to do The Mummy 3.
Yeah. So, studio director, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just so weird that he's produced this. Mm. I do understand it. I think it's very much a random thing that just kind of could and couldn't have, shouldn't have happened.
Didn't they bring him back for the second one? What was his?
I don't remember. I think he just taken out entirely. Yeah. I don't think anything particularly. He worked on like XXX with Vin Diesel.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think he has quite a good relationship with Vin Diesel, and so that he probably went
the
with
loyalty
him.
Split. Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of this, you know, the fact that the dialogue had to be improvised because the script was half written and was written with someone else in mind. A lot of that could be put down to it being, it sounds like it was kind of a rush production. You know, they didn't know that they were going to have such a hit on their hands with the Fast and the Furious. And so they suddenly had to turn around and go like, oh, great. Well, okay, we'll make another one of those.
And as Matt mentioned earlier, it's a year later.
Yeah.
Like this is, 2002 is the first one. 2003 is the second one.
2001 and 2003, but that's why I couldn't do in 2002 for 2000.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. 2 years later. Sure. Yeah.
But still, it's very fast around.
Yeah.
And the thing is, no one expected this good to be good at all.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a plan at all. And also, to be fair to this film, it actually made more money than the first one.
Yeah.
People forget that shit.
So in terms of budget and stuff, you've got the first one had a $38 million budget. This doubled that, over doubled it. Well,
painful.
No. Yeah. $76 million for the second one. And it did a little bit better in the box office, but not demonstrably. It's about $206 million for the first one and then $236 million. So only $30 million more, which is weird considering that, like I said, the juggernaut that this series is now.
Oh, yeah.
From, like, I think, like, 5 did pretty well, but 6, 7, and 8 did incredibly well. One of them broke $1 billion or something.
If I'm being cynical for a second, join me. Seven broke $1 billion, not because it was necessarily very good, but because it was the Paul Walker send-off, because it was one that completely...
Absolutely.
I think that was very much...
Everybody cries and listens to Charlie Puth and
looks
at his brother with a CGI'd face on him, and it's all a bit weird.
Mm.
Yeah. So something I'd like for you guys to think about, have a little guess. Bring back the Rotten Tomatoes score for Too Fast, Too Furious. Any suggestions?
Correct time recording, I would say... Not too low. I'd say maybe 35%.
Okay, 35 from
Matthew. This is low, but it's, you know, not crazy low.
I'm going to say higher than that. I'm going to say like 48%.
And just to be fun, I will go lower. I'll go 25.
Matt is almost bang on. It's 36.
Shit, really?
36.
How did the original one do?
The original one is slightly higher.
It's got to be like 45, 50 max. No one's going to give it that much. Again, the critics of the time, as we were discussing before the show started, wouldn't have understood it. It's like, you damn kids and your fast cars. It's not like American Graffiti. Now that was a real movie with cars. That kind of bullshit.
It's only slightly higher. It's 53. So so we go in order, 53, 36, 38, 29 for number 4.
Yeah.
And then 77, 70, 81, and 67.
So they've been critically acclaimed.
They've
just been better than shit.
Yeah. The only one that breaks 80% is 7. Again, like you said, it's there.
Which again has one of the
send-off and all that kind of stuff. And it's like,
That's one that starts with the
who knows? They're all the
coming
same.
Out of the plane.
That's the one that starts with the cars. It's not making the driver faster than the Furious.
No, it starts with the bikes.
Wait, hold on. Is that the one that starts with the cars?
And ends with the cars.
Oh!
I think it's the one that...
Does it have cars in the middle?
Where they parachute out of a plane.
With
a tank.
That's
6, I think.
That is in number 7.
Yeah. It is 7.
Just a side note here, I was having a conversation with Philippa about The Fast and the Furious, and there was this hazy 20 years ago recollection where I was trying to describe to her the premise for The Fast and the Furious, and in turn she was trying to describe to me the plot of Gone in 60 Seconds, because in her head those two had just become
same time. Yeah. Can you imagine if Gone in 60 Seconds became the huge franchise that The Fast and Furious is, and Nicolas Cage is still let's ride.
It's like, gone, what is this gone shit? In 59 seconds. Oh, imagine if they'd merged. Imagine if there was a shared
gone
universe
in some furious there. Seconds. I love it.
Gone very fastly and very furiously.
I like gone in fast seconds.
Hey, listeners, do you know how we're going to fucking fix this?
Fast seconds sounds suspect. We'll just...
Talking about gone in 60 seconds, there is another film around this time that I think is that Too Fast, Too Furious is a slightly grittier version of, more than it is a Fast and Furious film. And that is the fucking Dukes of Hazzard film.
Oh,
that they
God.
Did.
Wow.
Because with Owen Wilson?
It was Johnny Knoxville and Sean William Scott.
Yeah. What?
God, fucking I forgot hell. That existed.
Jesus
Who
Christ.
Who was Daisy Duke in that?
That was Jessica Simpson.
It was Jessica Simpson. Christ.
Directed by the dude who did Super Troopers, wasn't it?
I can't remember for the sure director, Jesus but yeah, just like the fact that it ends with a car like jumping onto a boat and the...
Tyree specifically says we're about to do some Duke of Hazzard shit.
Exactly, yeah. I think it weirdly feels closer to that in terms of like, here's some guys messing around in a car.
Did they come out in the same year as well?
No, I think it was 2005 okay. Dukes of Hazzard came out, but it's
that's close
enough. There was clearly an interest in like, yeah, we definitely. Can do films about cars.
That's a good premise. Let's do films about cars because that worked for Pixar. So in terms of fixing Too Fast, Too Furious, Singleton's a problem. The script itself and the story itself is a problem
because it doesn't feel like a fast
because it doesn't relate to the first one. Yeah, they just fucking move it for no reason and it loses so much from that first one. So
it's very spin-offy.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like an isolated thing that could be not a Fast and Furious movie. It could be something totally different. But we got Brian. Good old Brian's in there. And speaking of Brian, casting. I think casting also needs to be fixed. Because, yeah, having a script that isn't finished aimed at people who aren't there, it's not a good look. So if you actually write a story that relates to the people who are there and you have a decent cast... People with actual chemistry on screen would help. That would be lovely.
And possibly a Vin Diesel.
Oh, a bit of Vinny in there. Good old Mark Sinclair, I think his real name is.
Named after the ZX Spectrum.
So, why don't we go about fixing this garbage sequel, shall we, gentlemen?
I guess that's
what
we're here
for. That's the name of the game. That's
the premise of the show.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yep.
So I'm going to pass over to my good friend, my colleague, Tim. How would you like to fix Too Fast and indeed Too Furious?
We're keeping the title.
I had a run. We're keeping the title. The title is actually
with numbers?
Good. With the numbers. Okay. Yeah. Because it's exactly the level of ridiculous that you want.
it's tonally appropriate.
And I think that what I was looking to kind of do when I was thinking about the writing is essentially accelerate slightly the journey to number five.
The journey to the rock.
The journey to the rock. because two and three and four all exist at more or less the same level. And then there's a big jump up in five. And so bridge that slightly, bring together some of the aspect, some of the things from two, some of the things from four, and hopefully just kind of
pick the two worst films in this entire franchise.
Well, yeah,
and
but
match them together.
Essentially,
into something good.
I want to jump from the road of the Fast and the Furious to the boat of Fast Five, and miss the water, the murky waters of two, three, and four.
Touché, sir. Well played. Well played.
So we start off with Brian Paul Walker.
Good old Brian.
Still in LA. Now working with the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms Bureau, or whatever their force.
Department.
Department's not a sex.
It is if you say it like this. Department! Carry on, Tim.
So he's working with a gang, working with the ATF to capture a gang that is smuggling weapons down to the cartels in Mexico, hidden among... car parts for, you know, tooled up street racing cars. And we're gonna the stuff in Too Fast, Too Furious about how he is on the run and then he gets picked up and has to work with the FBI again is all nonsense and
it
bad.
Is, yeah, yeah.
So we're just going to kind of jump over that by saying, by saying that he has this kind of gruff superior officer figure who is aware that he let Dom escape at the end of the first film, and he's kind of using that to keep him in line. So he's still working for the authorities, but he's on this kind of like, you know, you screw up one more time, I'm going to throw you in, you know, prison. I'm going to tell everyone what you did kind of stuff.
Classic cop tight leash stuff.
So, okay, introducing a new character. Interesting. Yep. Okay. Okay.
Yep. Meanwhile, we're going to jump down to Mexico, where Dom, Letty, and their crew, made up of whoever we want to include, basically, are hijacking fuel tankers and trying to stay off the grid, which is basically what they're doing in number four. Mm. So we get to have a nice, early, exciting hijacking scene. After that happens, we're going to have Dom approached by this kind of enforcer type figure, who I've written in my little script notes as Beefy Lieutenant.
That's my favourite flavour of super noodles.
Old Beefy L.
The big Beefy L. And he's going to reveal that the truck that they hijacked belonged to this crime boss, and that essentially they've disrupted his operations down in Mexico. They owe him for, you know, the fuel that's gone. They owe him for the disruption. Dom's going to have to work for the crime boss now, which is kind of the agreement he makes so that Letty and the others can go free, and it's just Dom working for them.
Okay. So you've introduced a few new characters already.
We've introduced a couple. Yeah. The kind of the important ones here are our gruff superior officer and our beefy lieutenant.
And crime boss as well?
Well, we will come to that.
Oh.
A little surprise there.
Interesting.
Well, Alec, do you want to, you kind of handled casting for this one. Do you want to walk us through who you picked for those?
Yeah, sure. I have to remember.
Who's your big beef man?
Your BLT.
Show us your beef, Plowman.
So I debated with beef whether the right...
Alec used to be vegetarian. Now he's not vegetarian. He debated with beef.
Yeah, well, that's true. Whether the... fact. Whether the right flavour of beef for... this particular beef,
I love the front,
is in fact Jason Statham.
Oh, a bit of British beef.
Yeah, bit of
McDonald's.
Yeah, 100% British Statham.
From farm to table Statham. Statham House.
Quick question we haven't addressed yet, I guess, is what year? Is it still 2003?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think...
I would assume so, anyway. Maybe, sorry, I'm jumping in there, but yes, make it 2003, Tim.
I think maybe push it back, like, a year, just to give them that time to...
Do it properly.
I'm trying to think, what is old Jay Stath up to? Transporter 1? Is that... isn't it?
Yeah. That's 2002, isn't it?
Yeah. He's working towards way towards Rock and Roller. Not Rock and Roller. Revolver.
He'll drop everything for a piece of beef this prime. It's not every day that you get Beefy Lieutenant.
Technically speaking, at this point, Fast and the Furious is not a big franchise.
Well, anyway, he's doing it. Statham's doing it. Statham's not that big at this point. He's not big enough to turn me down, so he can fuck off.
Just to throw a spanner in the works.
Oh, a beefy spanner.
I've seen like 8 Fast and Furious films. I don't know any car terms. Because those films are not about cars.
Get a wrench in the pipes.
So I had an issue with Statham because again, he's a solid cast idea.
You
he's
don't
fine.
Like people from London.
Yeah, but he's not from London. He's
enough,
from King's Lynn, isn't he?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I don't pretend they're from London when they're from King's Lynn.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, because I think his presence in the Mexican cartel would be weird.
That is very
true. Wait. Is Jason Statham doing brown face for this film?
You know, he also put out
LJ So Statham.
I'm sorry, but you put the word beefy and lieutenant on
in
the
a Mexican.
Where are you going to go with that?
Find a beefy Statham. Mexican.
Well, I don't know then.
Have some Mexican beef available at Subway.
I'm sticking with Statham. Tim will make it work. It's fine.
I think, you know, all it needs is a couple of lines of like, this guy's ex-special forces, and we board him over, and
he's been off the grid.
He's been off the grid.
Mm. And then he just needs to turn around and go, olay.
Because he fucking would.
Yeah.
And then who did you have for gruff superior officer?
So for gruff superior officer, a man who is... I think, fresh out of rehab at this point.
So you're going Robert Downey Jr. for Iron Man style.
Yeah.
This is going to be the role that's going to transform his life. And
somebody who's on the cusp of a comeback at this point is good old Mickey Rourke.
Mm-hmm. Fucking the wrestler himself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As a man who can do gruff, as a man who can, you know,
be an expendable film.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk more about Rourke and the significance of him as well when we come to the director.
Oh,
so we'll save that for now.
A little tease.
Because, 2004 is where he does start like a huge comeback.
Yeah. And I feel that this is the kind of role that he would come back into.
Yeah.
So after Dom encounters the Stafe.
The beefy Stafe.
The beefy Stafe.
A bald off.
Beefy Lou should be the actual character name.
Just BLT, Beefy Lieutenant, BLT.
Genius, Matthew.
So we're sticking with BLT.
BFLT, that's what we're calling it.
Yeah.
BFLT.
I'm BFLT. We jump back to LA and we have Brian meet up with Tej, who is in Too Fast, Too Furious, played by Ludacris. Perfectly happy with that. I think he does a good job in these films.
Who doesn't like Ludacris?
He's quite charming.
Yeah. And we basically have him playing the same role. We have him as a contact in the street racing world and a mechanic. And he kind of reveals that the weapons dealer that Brian's trying to track down has been recruiting drivers from these street races. So we get a fun street racing scene where Brian wins the race in order to kind of meet up with this recruiter who we have a childhood friend of Brian's named Roman.
Bringing back Roman.
Okay. Yes, but we are making a change here.
Good.
We are bringing back Roman.
Okay.
We are not bringing back Tyrese.
Good. So far, so good.
How do you feel about
so far,
Rob
so
Schneider?
How do you feel about
Jason Statham's Mexican, Rob Schneider's African American?
Well, how do you feel about two performances from Jason Statham?
Jason Statham's twin.
Too Fast, Too Furious, two roles.
Two Jasons, two Stathams. Oh no.
I'm from LA now. Hola.
Oh, good lord. So you're recasting Roman?
Yes. Yeah.
Who are we recasting him as?
We're gonna go somebody who was kind of quite prominent around this time, had been in ER for a bit and had just done 8 Mile.
Which is ER is like, what the fuck, how does that relate to anything? 8 Mile, a little bit more relevant.
Mackay Pfeiffer.
So we're gonna keep Roman, but we're recasting him. The other thing we're gonna keep is the extremely shitty fight that he and Brian have.
Yes,
because it's brilliant.
It is a shitty fight.
It's
it's a playground.
Feels real.
It's crap. Yeah,
it's end of Bridget Jones level, like realistic. Yeah. In fact, possibly even more so because no one crashes through a window.
Goes through a window. I just thought that. Yeah,
yeah.
There's more drama in Bridget Jones than
Yes. So they have their terrible fight.
Less drama than Bridget Jones.
And we're not even going to have it be about like, oh, you know, I went to prison because of you. We're going to have it something like really stupid.
You ate my sandwich.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be like back when we were 12. You borrowed my copy of Frogger without asking or something.
Frogger's an interesting choice. I thought you'd like Hot Wheels cars or something like that. Or a racing game.
Frogger?
But Frogger it's about crossing the road. It makes sense.
So as they cool off afterwards, Roman explains how he got kind of drawn into this life of crime. And he explains that the crime boss that he's working for is very bad news.
How do they cool off afterwards, Tim? Is it with a beer or is it with like a kiss?
It's with a beer and a kiss.
Yeah.
And of course that beer is Corona.
Clink. Yeah. Corona. Just want to make sure we're embracing where this series is going.
Yeah. And Brian says, Brian promises he'll be able to get Roman a pardon in exchange for his help. But Mickey Rourke's character sort of comes in again and sort of says, you know, Brian, you're skirting close to the edge of the law, you know, be careful basically. We have Brian and Roman transport the cars that contain the weapon parts down to Mexico. And it's here that they reunite with Dom, who is driving one of those big multi-car transporters.
Oh, nice.
And we have the Mexican authorities show up and we get a nice big action scene at the kind of like beginning of second act part. With them like ejecting the cars from the transporter and driving away while in motion. I haven't like scripted the everything in the second half of the film because obviously we've switched format slightly, but we follow a series of clues, and it's eventually revealed that the crime boss is in fact Gruff Superior Officer Mickey Rourke. Big twist.
Nice twist.
Who's been funneling weapons to the cartels to kind of keep them off American soil and get rich in the process.
He's later elected president.
He is later elected president.
Build the wall. Build the wall.
Roman leaves because he's upset that his pardon is clearly off the table. So Brian and Dom go to confront Mickey Rourke, and he escapes in a helicopter with Statham manning a machine gun, on the outside.
Yep.
And our heroes seem done for until Roman shows back up with Letty and all the others in tow, kind of reuniting the family. And then we defeat at least Mickey Rourke and possibly Statham, unless we want him to jump out early and save himself for a sequel, perhaps.
We absolutely do.
Yeah. We're going to defeat them using the launch a car at a helicopter trick from Die Hard 4, which came out after this. Mm. So we're stealing it ahead of time because it suits this film so much more than it did Die Hard 4.
It really does. Yeah, you're right.
So the main sort of problems we're addressing are, like we said, make it feel more like a Fast and Furious film and kind of bridge that gap between the relatively grounded first one and the total ridiculousness of the third. So
I feel like this is the acceleration towards the batshit insanity of the
latest. Yes, we haven't quite hit that NOS button, but we're building up to that.
Nice, yeah.
So jumping in from that, something that I feel we also need to address in this. So we have a returning Vin Diesel, which is good.
Yes, a key thing that could have possibly saved this film.
But I think we need to think a bit more about what Vin Diesel and Paul Walker's relationship is in this movie.
Sexual. Erotic?
Almost certainly both. No. I think... So what I'd like to add to what Tim has got is a bit of motivation for some tension between those two characters, because sexual I feel tension. Like you can't just drop Vin Diesel back in and these two reunite as if nothing has happened.
Well, it's unfinished business, isn't it?
The end of the first one. So the things I would like to add is that there is a sense of hostility between those two characters for two reasons, which is number one, that Vin Diesel is angry at Paul Walker because he feels like he betrayed him, even though Paul Walker is somewhat has his hands tied because he's acting under duress because of this superior officer. But Vin Diesel needs to resent him for that, and also because of his comment in the first film that, you know, okay, you're dating my sister, if you ever mess her around I'm gonna kill you, there needs to be some repercussions for that. Paul Walker and her need to be estranged in this film, and that to me needs to be a source of tension, their relationship and also how Vin Diesel responds to it, with those characters then coming together at the end of the movie and being able to reconcile those differences because of the realization that there is a greater enemy at work.
I very deliberately put their reunion very almost immediately turns into an action scene, because that stops them. It stops Vin Diesel from just going over and kicking Paul Walker's ass. and it also then means that they can, you know, bond a little bit in that moment of, you know, action and tension. And I think Four actually did a reasonably good job of the moment when they first reunite and they're both pursuing the same guy from different angles. And I think that dynamic works well for them of having more or less the same goals, or at least the same enemy, but coming at it from two different directions. And I think the thing that you mentioned about the relationship with the sister is very true as well. I always think it's so weird that like they bring in Eva Mendes and give Paul Walker a love story in this one.
Even though it's an established love story in the first one.
Yeah.
And it's just like, just ignore that.
And then they bring that established love story back, and it becomes quite like central to his whole arc for the rest of the films.
Yeah, that was something that always felt really off to me when watching the second one.
Yep.
And again, just how far away it felt from the first one. So I really feel like you need to... That needs to be central to alternative Fast and the Furious 2.
Yeah. Should point out that even in the prelude, doesn't cover it.
Nope, yeah. Nothing.
He looks in the mirror for a little while, then hangs his badge up.
Yeah,
that's about it.
Has a quick wank, you know.
I mean, it's implied.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing in Too Fast, Too Furious about that implies that the events of the first film really happened at all.
Yeah, yeah. Or, it's two completely standalone, unrelated events.
Or impacted Brian's character at all. Like, we need to show that he, you know, is not viewing things so black and white now, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that the reunion with Vin Diesel is a key point there. And I really like your idea there, Tim, and kind of telling him what you were saying, like, of when they reunite, you instantly throw them into an action scene. And like, imagine them, like, reluctantly fighting side by side, and they do the, like, almost like a classic back-to-back thing, and they're like, oh yeah, we've done this before, we know each other, like, we do have the same goals at the end of the day,
kind of common thing. Enemy as well.
Yeah, common enemy is the perfect example of that. Yeah,
I don't know how you could do it with them being in different cars, but I like the idea of them sort of arguing, shouting at each other.
Let me tell you, walkie talkie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, having to cooperate,
drivey talkie.
But also getting out all of this annoyance at each other, you know, shouting at each other while doing amazing things in cars.
So while they're driving and shouting, would you describe them as fast and furious, Alec?
I would describe them as too fast and too furious. Because they should really be concentrating on what they're doing. But it makes for a very good sequence.
Yeah.
That's what this franchise is all about. Disagreements between two cars driving next to each other. The fast and the furious. So... that's the plot sorted, casting sorted, Vinny's back, got Statham in there as a Mexican guy for some reason.
No, yes, we do.
No worries, no problems there. Mickey Rourke double crosses everybody, a better Roman, I'm liking it so far. What about Singleton, Matthew? Sorting out this director.
So
what's the plan?
For me personally, I again, I can't stress this enough. Singleton.
Paul W.S. Anderson.
Wes Anderson.
The Willy Slinger is driving shift.
Former professional wrestler Arn Anderson.
The Boys in the Hood gets Singleton so much credit in my eyes because I genuinely adore that film. Yeah. I think he did a fantastic job with it. And unfortunately, his later career is pretty not good.
Yes, correct.
So there was a comment I mentioned earlier, which is credited to Singleton, saying, oh, I wanted to create something like Top Gun. So the logical choice is to literally go straight to the source and just bring on old man Tony Scott. Now, so Tony Scott...
How old is Tony Scott at this
point? I don't know, he's like in his 50s or some shit.
I thought you were going like 7. I have no idea how old Tony Scott is.
He's in his
70s.
But he's, you know, older than John Singleton.
Sure.
And Rob Cohen. And also very English. So the key point is that not only has he directed Top Gun, at this point he's also of relevance. Directed Days of Thunder, again, a NASCAR wrestling movie, so he gets the visuals. He's done True Romance with the sort of crime element to it. He's done Crimson Tide, so we've got the tension going on as well there. And Enemy of the State, which again feels like a kind of sort of tone with what we're trying to go with that tension and running forward.
Yeah, definitely.
More importantly, in 2004... he does what I like to think is maybe Tony Scott's best film, Man on Fire with Denzel Washington.
Oh, what a fucking film.
I adore that film. So I think
I love that movie.
2004, pushing this. We're not going full on, oh no, we've gone too far, Domino, the Bounty Hunter, but bringing a lot of elements of that. And one key point is that Mickey Rourke is in Man on Fire. Mm-hmm. He's the smaller role, but it's him starting to work his way back. So him and Scott will obviously get on that regard. I think are quite nice. More than that, Man on Fire being set in Mexico City, and it has a beautiful visual style and a really interesting way of doing things like subtitles and this sort of record scratch style thing with different languages. I think that could be incorporated in this really nicely. So you won't go full pelt that sort of style because it's so disparate from what we've had in...
You have got that Mexican connection with the cartel in this film. So
exactly.
So you can still elements that kind of dynamic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Elements that can still come in and be utilized quite well. So we take on board a lot of those sorts of things. And I think, again, keeping the not just bland ass subtitles, but making them part of the visuals and make again the action would be incorporated into something that's really quite entertaining. And not only that, bringing his team with him, the editorial people who would work on things like Top Gun, who basically save something that's been, oh god, this is a terrible film, no one's going to like it, to suddenly reworking all the flyover shots and the various MiGs and other bits and pieces of planes, and it's become this really compelling, extremely homoerotic action film, which is why he's perfect for this.
Yeah.
Playing with Vin Diesel.
playing with the stage.
That's all you're going.
So I think, yeah, Tony Scott's a very strangely logical choice, oddly enough, for this kind of film.
To oil up those two bald men and watch them go.
Pretty much. And I think he can juggle that kind of disparate storyline that goes between two very different styles of storytelling, because we do have like a bisected plot between the cartel stuff in America.
A what plot? Sorry,
bisected.
Oh, okay. Carry on.
Read a book, Jack. Jesus. Between the stuff in Mexico and the stuff in Los Angeles, and to be fair, LA is a very Latin sort of influenced city as well. So you do have that sort of flow.
Name is literally in Spanish.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but that's the point. I think you can bring a lot of harmony between those things, and I think visually and audibly he could do that really, really well in an interesting style, in a way that unfortunately I didn't think Singleton could. And yeah, with this story, I think the story isn't, in my opinion, would be strong enough to call Vin Diesel back. He could still do his Chronicles of Riddick until we sequelize it later.
Can I just say, just as a quick aside here, it's so weird the way that Vin Diesel went there, that because he had three massive franchises, or potential franchises at the time, Fast and the Furious, Triple X, and Pitch Black. And he turned around and went, yeah, Chronicles of Riddick is where it's at.
Yeah, I'd like Pitch Black without any of the tension or horror and stuff, please. That'd be
yay!
Great.
Yeah,
cool.
I'd like Pitch Black, but I got this D&D character that I created. Can I be that instead?
Can you make it generic sci-fi crap? I mean, those films are fine,
but it's such a weird. Imagine what Vin Diesel could have been if he'd said yes to all three, and why the hell didn't he at that point?
It's Vin Diesel's a very strange individual, to be honest. I mean, things like, you think he's appeared when he was very unknown in things like Saving Private Ryan, The Iron Giant,
and a Street Sharks commercial.
And a Street Sharks commercial, obviously. Callback. But then, you know, and then he's finally, we keep always forgetting that he is in the MCU as well as Groot. Mm. So it's just like, oh yeah, Diesel. And then you see him in the Fast Furious film. He's like Fate of the Furious. Is that what Fate's
called?
That
is
And that kind of stuff. You're like, oh yeah. And he still feels like he's kind of almost angry to be there, looking over his shoulder and gruffing about something or other. And it's like, oh yeah, you look tired, man. Do you want to be here?
Do you like being an actor?
I feel like he's becoming Harrison Ford.
Oh.
Just pointing, talking about his family, and then just looking over his shoulder and go,
they both,
and just
mumble and just,
can I kill my character off yet? And then hate the other cast members. So yeah, Singleton has to go, in my opinion. We discussed this early on. I wanted to keep Singleton for a long time. I thought, no, I think he can do this. And then you look at behind the scenes stuff and you look about, as you say, about the improv, and like, he can't. He has
to
go.
He didn't know what he was
really
doing.
Really disappointing, unfortunately. But again, and others are like, okay, so you brought this guy who's, again, from South Central Los Angeles, the South American dude. Who are you bringing in? Some fucking Geordie white guy. It's like, oh, good work, white boys. And it's like, well, to be fair, everyone's just trying to emulate his style. Why don't you just bring him in to create something new and different? And to be fair, I think if he had done that and created something that had been very vibrant and colorful and energetic, we would have got immediately to Fast Five in the third film, in our third film.
Okay.
And then from there, you'd have gone, the hype machine would have been real and been much more, not grounded, but definitely more of an actual credible powerhouse, basically, and make them every 4 years or something rather than every two or whatever. And then you wouldn't have to. And again, imagine bringing The Rock in at that point. It'd be like, what, 2008? Hmm. A good time to bring The Rock in because he's not doing that much.
Yeah, what's The Rock doing in 2008? He did like Walking Tall and Welcome to the Jungle, or whatever the fuck that name was called.
Which was a good film.
Welcome to the Jungle's great.
Or the Rundown from Americans.
Christopher Walken as the bad guy.
Mm. Yeah. I think the thing with Singleton as well is that if we're looking to step up the action in this and just the size of the set pieces, he doesn't really have that experience, especially when you compare him to Tony Scott, who you know, has done Top Gun, has done, you know, these...
Top Gun and Man on Fire sells it for me straight away.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Like you said, Matt, Top Gun is the one that they're basically emulating with this style, this... Mm. Homoerotic,
the camaraderie, and the
camaraderie, yeah, yeah.
And the fact they're both on the same side but with slightly different agendas. Again, you can take that of almost quite a lot of Scott's early films. Again, Days of Thunder, you've always got like this adversarial person who's kind of the same guy, basically. Again, we're just basically merging. This is one of those things where we're not just scrapping it all together, we are effectively pushing it all together. We're merging what works into a credible story to leapfrog to. Or Frogger, if you will. Leapfrog to Fast Five, which we know is ultimately, if you talk to Fast and Furious fans, almost everyone ranks that as the top.
Yeah, five or six. People love six as well, but yeah. It's a weird thing, because I think it's the first example of a franchise of the multiple films where it gets better later on that we've fixed.
Yeah.
Because, like, you think, like, Pirates of the Caribbean, we fix the second one, people are like, oh, I quite like the second one. But, like, yeah, but three and four are fucking garbage. Like, it gets worse and worse and worse. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, the success that it has is really, it's kind of a perfect storm. And I think that's why, like, a lot of this is, you know, we've been trying less to come up with a completely new film like we sometimes do, and more just steer it towards the things that we know that do work about the franchise, that will come to be very good about the franchise, and, you know, trim out some of the things that don't work.
Yeah, it's a unique
cough,
beast.
Tyrese, cough.
Yeah, yeah, it's a unique beast in Hollywood, and then as I kind of mentioned, and as you've kind of explained a bit more there, Tim, it's a unique challenge for the three of you, because you know it does work later on. And it's essentially accelerating that, like you said, Matt, bridging that gap and jumping off onto the boat of five and kind of merging four in there a little bit and fuck Tokyo Drift and kind of getting it all working together, because we know it can work so well later on. So well done, gentlemen. Yeah, I think you've successfully two-fixed this Furious or whatever the fuck. I don't know. I tried.
Good job. Good job, Tank. Nice try.
That's my contribution to the show. I think, Singleton needs to go. Tony Scott's a good choice. Plot makes more sense. Bring back in the previous crew. Bring it all back together. Vin Diesel's back. Bit of Mickey Rourke. Yeah. Mekhi Phifer's an interesting choice. I think he would bring something a bit more interesting to Roman, because fuck me, Tyrese, not good. Well fixed.
And we got Statham.
Oh, yeah, and Mexican Statham. Or his Mexican non-union equivalent, Senior Stathamo. If you have any ideas about how to fix Too Fast, Too Furious, if you disagree or agree with our choices here from my esteemed colleagues, let us know. Tweet at us. We're Sequelizers on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all that good stuff. And if you really want to get stuck in, you can email us, sequelizers@gmail.com. If you wish to support this debauchery, patreon.com/sequelizers is the place to go. Throw your dollars? Does it change to pounds?
Throw your dollar
British?
Down.
Throw your dollar down.
Throw
a beat down.
Throw your hands in the air, then bring them back down again and...
Put them in your pockets, pull out some money.
And push it at the screen. I don't know how Patreon works.
Rub it on your phone and everything will be fine. How can people follow you on the internet, Matthew?
So, yeah, if you want to follow me, you can, depressingly. You can go to either Twitter or Instagram and follow Stoggz, Stoghz. You can read my reviews at the Red Right Hand. You can watch my filmmaking stuff at Cheese Mint. And you can pretty much, you know, Google all that shit and it'll come up. I think that's about it, really. Oh, and I drag race on Thursdays. My car is luminous green with some underlights. The underlights
luminous
are also
green
luminous
for your
green.
Irish heritage, yeah.
That's a coincidence. Yeah. I mean, the guy at the dealership chose it, so.
Fair enough.
But he might have sized me up, so it might have been racism.
Yeah.
So, but my racing name is Matthew Stogden. Throws the police off.
With zeros instead of O's and stuff.
No. It's spelled correctly, sir. It's not my full name. It's not my three middle names, so it's fine.
Fair enough.
Yeah, thanks. So, I'll see you down the track. The track being Lidl's.
Yeah.
Car park, 2 a.m.
Speaking of meeting people on the track, how can people follow you on the internet, Mr. Matum?
I am trivia_lad on Twitter. That's probably the best way to find me. I do have an Instagram, but I barely use it, so it's not worth me pimping that out. And then, yeah, most of my projects I tend to shout about on Twitter anyway. And yeah, if you want to meet me on the track, it will be Dry Dry Desert in Mario Kart, and I will be not doing very well.
Oh, excellent.
I'm not good at video games.
Mr. Plowman, how about you?
I'm Alec _ Plowman on Twitter. That's Plowman. If you want to find me on the track, I will be racing a 1992 Vauxhall Nova 2-door. the lock on the right door is broken, but there's really nothing of value in the car. I don't have a license, which I like to see as a plus. I think it makes things very interesting. The police seem to disagree.
More edgy.
Seeing as I can't get over 55 miles an hour in my particular speed machine, it's not a problem anyway. But that will be me on the track with Matthew Speedy Shoes Stogden in his...
Flintstones car, apparently.
His Flintstones
Speedy Shoes.
You can follow me, JLW Chambers, on pretty much everything. Probably even like Pornhub and stuff like that, because, you know.
Tinder?
No, not anymore. I was briefly on Tinder when I was single between long relationships, but yeah. That's it for Sequelizer this week. But until then, that doesn't make any sense.
Keep your engines full and your foot on the gas and your dipstick flush and your boots full of jelly and all the things happening. And we'll see you later.
Check your tire pressure.
Oh yeah, that's a good thing. It's very dangerous otherwise. Yeah.
Check tire pressure.
And your windscreen wiper fluid's we'll full.
Make sure you've always got a bottle of water in the glove box in case you're stranded.
And a gun in case you get stranded.
See you in 2 weeks, folks, with your guns and bottles of water.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, Paul W.S. Anderson.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.